This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Richard Ady. Welcome to the show. Hope you had a good weekend. We're going to look at easing the financial burden of childcare today. Actually, it's a bit of a theme this week. And look, if you're paying upwards of $70 a day per child, lots of people are, you can stand a bit of easing of the burden. We're also going to start thinking about siblings this morning, the relationships they have as adults. That's later. Military spending in Australia has just received a $10 billion boost. The priority will be to expand the army with an additional 2,600 troops. But the high attrition rate from the Defence Forces means it's proving difficult to maintain current numbers, let alone boost recruitment. The Prime Minister's targeted school cadets as a recruitment source, saying even though participation's much less than it was 40 years ago, those involved now were more likely to regard it as the beginning of a lifetime experience in the military. School cadets units were more or less disbanded by the Whitlam government, but in 2001, funding was increased to $30 million a year. So first today on Life Matters, we're going to find out more about school cadets from the leader of the biggest school program in the country, the commanding officer of the Knox Grammar School Cadets Unit, John Gibson, joins us now. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Richard. How are you?
I'm well. Now, how big is the school cadet program at Knox?
It's quite a substantial part of the school and has been for a long time. At Knox, we have a cadet unit of over 550 boys, up to 600 boys, depending on year to year. And that's quite a substantial cadet unit, as you can imagine.
How many adult officers would be involved?
24 at the moment.
Right. So do all the boys do this?
They do it for 1 year. In year nine, our boys do 1 year of cadets. It's a part of their school program. But from that point on, it's voluntary. And we find that after the boys have done their compulsory year, usually about two-thirds of the following year tends to go on with cadets. And then it drops down as they get towards HSC level. So that two weeks ago, we had a passing up rate of our year 12 cadets. They're the boys that have gone right through to HSC level. Mm-hmm. And there were 92 boys passed out of the unit evening.
You must be fairly chuffed with that kind of retention rate.
Oh, well, it's very much a part of the school's ethos, and the boys enjoy it. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Right. How long has it been going, John?
It's been going in this school since 1929. And in fact, it probably sort of goes a little bit before 1929. The then headmaster, a gentleman by the name of Neil McNeil, was an MC winner in the First World War.
Military Cross.
Military Cross winner, yes. And he was keen to sort of see drill and things like that, those sorts of things as part of a school program, which all seem terribly anachronistic now. And the cadets grew out of that program that he started at the school.
Now, anachronistic, I mean, I wondered about that. Why does Knox place such a value on having a cadet program?
Look, the real value of the program is probably threefold. The most obvious area of benefit for it, as far as we as a school are concerned, is that the cadet program, and remember, it's not only schools that have cadets. Cadets also these days exist as community-based organisations as well. But from a school's point of view, what cadets does is give you a program of youth training in a military context. So it's in a structured context, but where boys can genuinely, in our case boys, but boys and girls in many other units, can genuinely experience the challenges and the task of leadership and are given some practical training in leadership. So that's probably the most important thing as far as we as an educational institution are concerned. The second reason why we keep it is that it's a wonderful store of memories for our boys. The things that they do outside of the classroom are often the things that they remember, and you go to sort of 25-year reunions of boys and they'll tell you about things that they did at cadet camps and things like that.
Yeah.
And the third reason why we probably keep it is that it is, as I said before, an important part of the tradition of this school. It's one of the things that helps define the school and helps make it what we are.
I think many people would have a dated image of school cadets. It was big in the 50s and 60s. And it was disappearing when I was at school. Yep. That's for sure. How militaristic is the modern school cadet program?
It's really nothing like what most people, including probably the Prime Minister, would remember as school cadets. So I can remember as I was growing up, you'd go off to school with a 303 over your shoulder, and cadets were basically taught minor infantry tactics and things like that. All of that has changed. The military aspect of cadets that we retain are things like ceremonial parades, and our boys do a couple of big ceremonial parades every year, which they quite enjoy and are quite spectacular occasions. Apart from that, most of their training is essentially outdoor education training, adventure training, challenging stuff, and things like first aid, roping, those sorts of things done in the context of a military situation and done in the context of wearing a military uniform, but very much more an outdoor education, adventure training, leadership training program.
Do they still do the firearms training at all?
There's a very limited amount of firearms training left in cadets these days, partly as a result of just the shortage of weapons. Until relatively recently, cadet units often kept innocuous weapons that they could use for basic firearms training. In the wake of the massacre down at
Port Arthur. Mm.
Those weapons were, for the most part, entirely withdrawn from cadet units, and it became a matter of public policy. It was just people did not like seeing young people with rifles at all. Now there are a very limited number of innocuous weapons that can be used for ceremonial occasions, but one applies for them and they're supplied to them. On camps, senior cadets can get to fire a service rifle, but that requires a military presence, and it requires a coach for each boy or girl that's firing the rifle and things like that. So it's a very limited experience of it. Now, it's more to give the cadets an experience of military life rather than to train them in any way in a military setting.
On Life Matters this morning, our guest is Lieutenant Colonel John Gibson, who's leader of the cadet program at Knox Grammar School in Sydney. It's the largest cadet program in the country. John Howard has talked about emphasising traditional military values in recruiting for the armed services. Are they an important part of what you do?
I think our traditions as a military are stressed. Australia has an interesting relationship with the military. We've historically always had very small military forces and have relied on our reserves and things like that. It's interesting. It occurs to me, I was in Paris a month or two ago, and I happened to be in Paris for the 14th of July. And in Paris, or in France, the military is far more visible. 14th of July, you have a major military parade down the Champs-Élysées and things like that. We tend not to do that in Australia. And so the military in Australia tends to be a much less visible thing as part of our national culture. So people in Australia tend not to see the military terribly much. We only ever hear about it when it goes and does peacekeeping operations, or when it's deployed operationally for some reason, and generally that becomes a major piece of news. But
it's
for the
very
most
well,
part, we don't see it day to day.
It's very well thought of, though, John.
Yes, we generally have a very high regard for our military, and rightly so too. We have a small but very, very professional and very competent military.
So, do Knox cadets go on to military careers?
A relatively small number would go on to full-time military careers. There are a number of boys at the moment, or this weekend I had a couple of boys go down to the ADFA open day. It's interesting, out of say the 200 and something boys that would graduate each year, I'm guessing, but I would say that probably 10 to 15 would in some way or another have some connection with the military. Now, not all of those would go full-time military. One of the things that our boys have a long-term tradition of doing is going to the reserves through things like Sydney University Regiment, University of New South Wales Regiment, and becoming reserve officers. But that tradition is a long one. But even if they don't go into the military, you at least have a group of future citizens who have had the military to some extent demystified to them.
At present, I think only about 1% of adolescents in this age group across the country are cadets. Realistically, could this figure be improved?
Well, the program is a very, very good program. The cadet program is a wonderful program. And as I said before, it's not particularly military these days, but it does give the youth of the country a wonderful grounding in all sorts of skills that they would not otherwise come across. I suppose it really is a question of whether we want to spend public money on making it more and more available.
All right, John, I will let you get back to the classroom. But
thank you, Carney.
Thanks very much for explaining the cadet program at Knox to us this morning.
OK, bye-bye, Richard.
Bye-bye. Lieutenant Colonel John Gibson leads the cadet program at Knox Grammar in Sydney. It's the largest, one of the longest-running cadet programs in the country. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. It's about quarter past, coming up for 16 minutes past the hour. Next, alleviating the rising costs of childcare. We're listening to the music of mandolin Mike Marshall and his San Francisco Bay Area based group, Choro Famoso, playing beautiful choro music from Brazil on the Daily Planet this afternoon at 2:20 and tonight at 11:20 right here on ABC Radio National. Lovely, wasn't it? The government spends billions of dollars on childcare, but earlier this year, Liberal backbencher Jackie Kelly called the system a shambles. The Western Sydney MP was one of a group of Liberal women campaigning for childcare reform prior to the May budget. We currently fund childcare in two ways. There's an upfront childcare benefit and a childcare tax rebate. The coalition of Liberal women want a greater focus on work-based childcare or tax deductions for employers to buy places at other centres. This is one of the options being considered by the parliamentary inquiry into work-family balance chaired by Bronwyn Bishop, and we'll be talking to Senator Bishop later in the week. So what is the rationale for making childcare a tax deduction? Would it encourage more women to re-enter the workforce? Annette Trenant, a specialist advisor for Aegis Consulting, which advises business on childcare policy. Annette, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Richard.
What's the tax situation at the moment for employers who want to subsidise childcare, either by building a centre in their workplace or buying a place elsewhere?
At the moment, the only way employers can get a tax deduction or avoid fringe benefits tax on childcare is to actually have their own centre on their own premises. They aren't allowed to buy places in another centre. They have to actually run and control their own centre.
So a workplace centre doesn't attract fringe benefits tax, yet there aren't that many workplace centres. Well, why is that?
That's right. There are only about six companies in Australia who are running them. Most companies don't want to, partly because it's outside their core business and running a childcare centre is expensive and you've got a whole range of liability issues. But also because if you have a business, say, for instance, a hotel where you may, or a range of hotels where you might have 300 sites across Australia, which ones are you going to choose to put your childcare centre in? And generally what happens is head office staff get the childcare centre, but nobody else does, and that's not really fair.
How would the businesses you represent like to see the system changed for both employers and employees?
Well, they'd like to see fringe benefits tax removed on all of the childcare fees so that parents may decide to salary sacrifice for childcare and not attract fringe benefits, or employers may decide to pay for places in established centres and not have to pay fringe benefits tax on it.
Well, one of the businesses that would like to see tax changes is the Accor hotel chain. Scott Irwin's the Regional Human Resources Manager for Accor in Queensland. Morning, Scott.
Morning, Richard.
Have I said Accor right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Some people go Accor, but it's Accor.
Can you give us a snapshot of the nature of your workforce?
Yeah, the nature of our workforce, Richard, is we're the largest hospitality provider in Australia with five-star hotels such as Sofitel through to business-class hotels, Novotel, Mercure, Ibis Hotels. We've got a workforce of around 9,000 people in Australia, and about 55% of that workforce is actually female, and a lot of that female workforce is at childbearing age. So it's a significant issue for our hotel company.
So I imagine quite a lot of them were working casual and part-time, and there would be a demand for childcare.
Oh, absolutely. It's critical, and half of our workforce is casual by nature of the industry, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and one of the biggest challenges for most of the returning mothers and also returning fathers to work is childcare and the affordability of childcare. And one of the massive issues for our employees is making a decision, is it worthwhile even coming back to work? And that's a real challenge for our business.
Now, you've built an on-site workplace centre at Darling Harbour in Sydney, where you've got probably several hotels, I'd imagine. Are you planning any more?
Yes, at Novotel Olympic Park in Sydney is where we're planning with critical mass to actually build our own centre there as well. And that's the only way that we can get around providing that service and salary, sacrificing that for our employees, at least to give them some form of saving. But that is only feasible where we have critical mass of hotels and critical mass of staff. And obviously we've got 100 hotels across Australia in remote destinations, in regional centres, as well as all the major capital cities. And again, I think Annette made a point there that sometimes it seems only the few get the service, and we actually have to look after all of our employees, which is why, you know, we advocate that we've got to get rid of this FBT on employees paying for childcare.
This is an issue for you because you mentioned, there's the place at Darling Harbour in Sydney and at the Olympic site in Sydney. You're, of course, in Queensland, so your people have nothing at the moment, really.
Correct, unless they're prepared to get on a plane and go to Olympic Park. But I don't think the saving they're going to make there is good enough, even with Virgin and Jetstar Online. But I think that's the really big challenge. And of course, being in regional centres, we obviously are looking at, and eventually, hopefully, the government will see that employers need employees to work in their business, and return to work parents are a very important part of that. And childcare is one of the significant issues of stopping people coming back to work, and our business just can't afford that.
Now, the Treasurer, Peter Costello, is not in favour of tax deductions for childcare because he says it will only benefit high-income earners. What about that? Would the benefits be quite small for most of your workforce?
Yeah, I disagree with that. He's probably right. Of course, any tax deduction, the higher earner you are, the more tax deduction you'll get. But let's face it, if you're on a lower income, even a small tax deduction is something you could put towards the fuel, something you could put towards the nappy, something you could put towards the education of the child. So he's probably right in that sense. It'd be a larger tax deduction for a higher income earner. But we've actually surveyed our employees, particularly in the New South Wales area, before we embarked on the childcare centres we're looking at for the hotels. And that was one of the significant issues for our employees, and all of them are not in the higher tax bracket. And they can save up to about $30 a day in Sydney, because you talked about a $70 per day placement in Brisbane, well, or in Queensland. In Sydney, it's somewhere up to $100.
So it can be, yes.
Very expensive.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National and also Radio Australia. And our guests are Scott Irwin, who's the Regional Human Resources Manager for the hotel chain Accor in Queensland, and also Annette Trannett, who's an advisor for Aegis Consulting, which look at childcare issues. Annette, will making childcare tax deductible be more advantageous to our high-income earners?
It is, because of the amount of tax that they're paying. But it will advantage everybody. It depends on whether they lose the entitlement to CCB or not.
CCB?
Yeah, that's the upfront payment that the government makes to childcare centres.
Childcare benefit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they make it, it depends on how much you earn as to how much you receive of that. But once you're on about a combined income of $80,000... the CCB starts to cut out dramatically, and you're actually much better off with salary sacrificing. And a combined income of $80,000 is really, you know, a retail worker and an office worker.
Yep.
Or, you know, a part-time nurse and a teacher.
It doesn't go very far, especially in our larger cities, does it?
Oh, no.
Could there be a cap on tax deductions for high-income earners? That's the American system, I think.
That's right. American system cuts it out at just over $100,000.
Mm. Would a tax benefit only be payable if the fees went to a childcare centre, or would it cover other forms of care? I remember both Jackie Kelly and Bronwyn Bishop, and these are in the Liberal Coalition of Women who have been agitating on this issue, they want to include nannies.
That's right. Our original presentation that we made to Bronwyn Bishop was to include all sorts of childcare, including nannies, grandparents, anyone who was looking after children while parents worked, but also with an idea to extend it at some point also for aged care, so that more and more middle income and middle-aged people are looking after ageing parents. So at some point that's going to be as big a problem as childcare is now.
It's certainly right, because and at the moment, if we just focus on childcare, grandparents and relatives do a huge proportion of the childcare, and mostly for nothing.
That's right. And this is a way to reward those people, make it feel less onerous for them, perhaps, and for the parents who are handing the children over to the grandparents, make them feel, you know, a little less guilty, perhaps, about it. But also in the case of nannies and sort of backyard carers, if you like, it helps to catch some of that back into the tax system, because these people would have to be registered in some way.
If we go back to the idea of workplace centres, given the costs, are they only really feasible for the largest corporations in a way?
Yes, because the cost of running a childcare centre is huge.
Mm. Scott, if I could bring you back at this point, Scott Irwin's the Regional Resources Manager for ACOR in Queensland. What are your staff telling you? Do they want their kids in a workplace centre, or would they prefer community childcare centres?
A majority would prefer community-based, just closer to home, logistically easier. Either partner then can pick up the child pre or post-work, so that would be preferable, and hence the reason of taking the FBT and allowing salary sacrifice would probably be a preference for most people rather than a workplace centre.
And that issue of tax-deductible childcare, how important is that in bringing women back into the hospitality workforce?
I would suggest, talking to our return-to-work mothers, it's one of their number one issues. Flexibility is one, and obviously cost of childcare, and just weighing up the cost of paying for childcare versus the cost of earning a living.
Do you actually lose many female employees after they take maternity leave?
At different levels, yes, we do. I can't give you the exact numbers because I haven't researched that, but yes, we do. And again, coming back to our recent New South Wales survey, that was one of the hot ticket items of debating whether or not to even return, not only to full time work, but also to look at part time work, etc.
Annette Trenant from Aegis Consulting. Businesses have made a number of submissions to the Federal Treasurer, and some Liberal women, as we've mentioned, are pushing the cause. Why is Peter Costello so lukewarm on the idea?
I think there's a number of reasons for that. Partly within Treasury and the tax office, there is a feeling that it's not really a workplace deduction and it shouldn't be allowed. I think there is, within the government itself, they have in the past tended to be very even-handed between encouraging women to stay home and encouraging women to work. And this is something that they need to think more carefully about, perhaps, before they feel they can introduce it. But where we're coming into an age where we have such a low unemployment rate and we need to encourage people to go back to work, we're going to hear much more about this, because this is one of the ways where women can return to work and make it worth their while to do it. We have one of the lowest rates of women returning to work after childbirth.
You're right there, and we'll keep talking about it on Life Matters. Thank you to Annette Trenant, Specialist Advisor for Aegis Consulting, and also Scott Irwin, who's the Regional Human Resources Manager for the ACOR hotel chain in Queensland. I just mentioned we'll keep talking about it on Life Matters. Tomorrow we'll hear another idea of how to do this from the demographer Peter McDonald from the Australian National University. Now, later on Life Matters, we'll tackle a taboo subject, a mother who abandons her children. And we'll also talk about how siblings get along as adults. But next, another tricky one, where young teens are getting their information about sex. it's usually not their parents. An 11-year-old boy was suspended from school in New South Wales last week for showing pornographic pictures stored on his mobile phone to fellow students. He downloaded the images from the internet. His father was aghast, but this type of thing wouldn't surprise our next guest, who says that unfortunately many students, boys in particular, are getting a pretty distorted view of sexuality because of what they can so easily see on the net. James Roy is a children's writer and a former nurse who's worked with adolescents. He does a lot of work with schools, and he's drawn on this experience to write The S Word, A Boy's Guide to Sex, Puberty and Growing Up. James Roy, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty well. Now, you've written young adult fiction. Why did you decide to write this Boy's Guide to Sex?
There's a couple of reasons. Firstly, I used to be a boy, and I remember that when I was growing up, a lot of the information I received was from, for example, encyclopedias. And I think my mum thought for a while that I was going to be a fashion designer because she'd come into my bedroom and find me reading about sewing machines in the World Book Encyclopedia, which is one subject over from sex, of course. And so she, I'm pretty sure that's what she thought. The other reason is that I've got two daughters, and I would go into bookshops looking for books for them about sex and puberty and development because, you know, my wife would be willing to talk to them and I would like to be involved, but I don't know that I want to talk to my girls about that stuff. And being a writer, of course, I trusted books. So I'd go and look for books. And I noticed that there were a lot of books for girls about this subject. Most of them had purple covers and pink lettering and glitter and called things like The Fairy's Guide to Growing Boobs, you know. But very few of them were actually... There was nothing there for boys, is what I noticed. There was stuff for younger boys and younger kids. There was stuff for older young men. But there was nothing for mid-grade boys, which is grades 5 to 8. Well, not a lot anyway.
Really, because boys are already, you could argue, overloaded with information about sex. There's sexual words and images everywhere. Mm. Do they really need another book?
Well, that's the other thing that concerns me is I've spent a lot of time around young people as a nurse. I worked as a paediatric nurse and adolescent nurse, and also in my time as a children's writer, going to a lot of schools and visiting a lot of schools. And I feel pretty confident that a lot of these boys are getting a lot of information, but I'm not happy that the information they're getting is necessarily sound because a lot of it's coming from the internet.
Mm.
And as we all know, it's very easy for anyone to get on their browser and type a couple of words and suddenly they're getting, I mean, you can type in any number of different words and get subjects that are actually unrelated to that and a lot more sordid than that. And I from a purely selfish level, I don't particularly want my daughters going out with boys who think that what they've seen on a hardcore internet site is what sex is all about, because of course it's not. You know, I think hardcore pornography is very much about, you know, a range of positional information, if you like. Mm. And when you're bored with a blonde, you can have the brunette. Group sex is a normal kind of activity. And it's a very loveless kind of thing when it's in pornography, I think.
So it's a series of distorted views then, you'd say?
I think so. I think so. And I don't mean to sound prudish by that. I mean, when I was younger and you were younger, yeah, sure, boys and men looked at, I mean, soft pornography was
Playboy
freely,
and Penthouse.
Exactly right, exactly.
That was about it.
And I think there was a certain innocent curiosity to looking at a People magazine when we were kids. But certainly the access to hardcore pornography wasn't there. And that bothers me a bit that boys, young, really young kids, are seeing this stuff.
Your book deals not just with the biology and the mechanics of sex, but also dating and relationships. Girls' magazines are full of advice, but there's just not really the male equivalent, is there?
Not that I could find, no. As you said at the very beginning, there's a lot of stuff about the biology. But I think that if we want the current generation of boys and subsequent generations of boys to be strong, confident young men, they need to know where they fit in the world and as part of the male species, if you like. And it really concerns me that a lot of the time men are defined by a whole bunch of negatives. If you'd like an example, men can operate heavy machinery, but they can't operate a washing machine successfully. They can change a tyre, but they can't change a nappy. They're constantly looking to be unfaithful. And if you don't believe me, have a look at some of the women's magazines and the titles on the front that talk about how to know if your man's cheating on you or how to deal with a sleazy boss. And I'm really worried that boys are thinking that these negatives are what makes them up, what they're made up of. And I just don't agree with that at all.
On Life Matters this morning, our guest is James Roy, who's normally a children's author, but he's now written a different kind of book. It's called The S Word, A Boy's Guide to Sex, Puberty and Growing Up. Now, we've talked on Life Matters before about the importance of consent in a sexual encounter. How do you deal with that?
Well, to answer that question, the first thing I'd say is that one of the things I emphasise a lot in this book is that it's okay to say no. I really think there's a lot of pressure on kids. I mean, we throw the term peer pressure around a lot, but there's some truth to that. And I like to emphasise to young people that, you know, it's not uncool to say no and back away from that, and that consent is a really important part of that. I mean, sure, different states in Australia have different ages of consent and so forth, and I don't really go into that too much. I say that, you know, talk to somebody who knows about these things from the area in which you are, but by and large, my message is, if you aren't sure, just wait. And certainly, that's really the message, you know, wait.
You also use humour to talk about serious issues like this. Have you found that that's the most effective strategy for getting a message across to boys?
To kids in general, but yeah, boys as well, because I think kids have a really, really acute insincerity meter, I suppose.
Right.
And I've learnt from my time as a children's author presenting at a lot of schools that humour is what gets the kids in. That's what makes them realise that you're not just talking a whole bunch of theory, that you actually are relating to them.
The character who answers the email is Richard the Wise, which is three words I've never heard together, speaking of somebody called Richard. But anyway, he's funny, but he can be quite tough.
Yeah, tough love, you know, all that stuff. and I wanted him to be direct, but also, I mean, as a writer of fiction, I like character, and I thought I'd introduce my own character in the main narrative part of the book, if you like. Is I tried to be a gentle but warm, honest kind of character, if you like. But Richard the Wise, he, as the word suggests, you know, the cartoons that accompany Richard are of a Templar Knight, if you like, the Templar Knight of sexually aware young men, if you want. And he's tough. He says, you know, there's one particular email in there where a boy says, you know, I got hit in the groin by a cricket ball and I wasn't wearing protector and it really hurt. And will there be any permanent damage? And of course, Richard says, well, you know, if there is permanent damage, you'll know because there'll continue to be pain and get a doctor to look and so on. But at the end of the email, he says,
you goose.
You goose. Yeah. Next time you're playing cricket, wear a protector, you dick, you know.
Now, your book gives lots of practical tips on how to relate to girls, but I was struck by the list of what not to do, reminding boys that disgusting personal habits and getting drunk and vomiting aren't necessarily winners with girls.
Yeah, well, I don't think they are. And, you know, that I suppose, I'll be completely honest, that the main focus of that section of the book was really to provide some light relief and a bit of humour.
But it does underline that difference in that maturity gap that girls and boys have,
absolutely,
especially in early puberty. It's really quite vast.
Well, early and all of puberty. I do a lot of writers' camps with school groups and so forth, and when there's mixed groups of, say, year 9 and 10 kids, and the girls are sitting around talking about whatever girls talk about. I don't quite understand what that's about. And the boys are busily trying to jump over rubbish bins near the girls, as if the girls are really going to be impressed by that.
Yeah,
and I always think
it's cool.
And we've all done it. You know, men have all done it. And as I say in the book, men stop showing off just before their 130th birthday. It's kind of how we're built. But I would just love boys to get the message that, you know, what a girl really wants from you is somebody who's going to just talk to them and relate to them, and that's going to give you the edge. I mean, I've noticed in my daughter, I have two daughters and they both go to the same school, and my eldest daughter does drama. And the drama group has about 30 girls and there's four boys, and I think those boys are the ones that got it sorted out, you know. They hang around these girls, they're showing their sensitive side. These are the guys who are going to go well, you know.
Now, girls are bombarded with images of the perfect body, the perfect body they should have.
Yeah.
And we've talked on the show before about the damage that can do to girls. But what do boys worry about most in terms of the physical changes at puberty?
Somebody asked me this the other day. They said, you know, in my time on the adolescent unit at the kids' hospital, dealing with kids, and a lot of those kids had emotional problems. And some of those were boys. A lot of them were girls with eating disorders and so forth, but occasionally had boys with eating disorders or suicidal ideation. And I think really what underlines all that is just uncertainty and confusion about who they are. For example, if they're having crisis of sexual orientation, that's the obvious one to go for. But simply body image. I've seen boys who were big, buffy footballers but are a bit too big and a bit too buffy and end up on an eating disorder program simply because their body image has taken such a hit. And the opposite. I mean, I was in a school group the other day of year six kids, which in New South Wales, of course, is the last year of primary school. And all these kids were walking in, and some of these kids were hobbits. They were tiny little people. But then this boy walked in, he was 6 foot two.
Mm.
And I thought, my God, you know, this poor kid, what a crisis this kid's going through. He's not even in high school yet, and he's taller than his teachers. And yet he's looking at his mate sitting next to him who's 4 foot nothing, and he's thinking, he has to be thinking, this doesn't seem fair to me that I'm fully developed. I mean, yeah. When I was going to school, there were boys in year seven with beards the size of a house pet, and they were bowling thunderbolts at me, and I was this tiny little weed.
I can remember guys who clearly had to shave twice a day, really, in year seven.
Exactly, and that wasn't just their face. You know.
The other thing, I was thinking about this morning before doing this, and I remember that I wanted to, I'm quite a big bloke now, but when I was in my teens, I was sort of tall and skinny, and I wanted to be bigger. I wanted to be, you know, bigger and stronger, and I bet that's still an issue for teenage boys. They want to look physically powerful.
Yeah, I suppose they're keen to get in there and start shaving and look like their dad and all those things. They associate that masculinity with manliness, and that's not an accident. That's a biological thing, I suspect, as much as a conditioning thing. And I just like boys to understand that everybody goes through it eventually, and even if you haven't yet, you will, and it's, you know, it's just part of life's experience, really.
You actually have a chapter on image and being a man. Is there a lot of confusion out there about what masculinity is and how to be a man?
I suspect so, and that's why I put that chapter in, because I did feel that for a lot of kids it is the case when, as I suggested earlier, there are a lot of negative messages out there for boys about what a man is going to be. And, you know, I live in the Blue Mountains, and in the greater west of Sydney, I see a lot of young men who think that the epitome of being a big man is having a big engine in their car.
Mm.
And as I say in the book, you know, when you're dead a long time, and when you do die, which we all will eventually, people aren't going to stand at your funeral and say, he had a really impressive HSV Commodore or FJ or, you know, Big Falcon or whatever. They're going to say, this is the kind of person he was. And I think that's immeasurably more important than what kind of car you're driving.
Girls typically talk to their girlfriends. They talk a lot to their girlfriends. But do boys share their worries with one another?
Yeah, but they use a lot less words, I think. Actually, that's not strictly true. The girls lose a smaller vocabulary, I think, a lot of the time, but they use a lot more of the same word. As an example, you know, I couldn't believe it. He called me and totally texted me. Oh, my God, like, it was totally. And I hear them talk this way, and I think, I don't know what you're saying.
Mm.
Whereas boys are like, she's hot, yeah. And that's kind of, that's kind of it. But, yeah, I think some boys boys and girls aren't that different in that way. They have a peer group and they share or they don't share, depending on what kind of person they are.
But girls are, I think, happier to kind of show their vulnerabilities to each other than boys.
I think so. I think it's also a bit deeper than that. I think that as a matter of necessity, I think mothers talk to their daughters more about what's happening to their bodies. You know, if you go to school and you haven't had your period yet and it occurs while you're at school, then you are going to need to make these arrangements. So I think mums, as a matter of necessity, talk to their daughters more about this stuff. Whereas I think fathers, and I don't have a son, as you know, but I think fathers are more prone to say to their boys, oh, yeah, you'll sort it out. I sorted it out with Playboy and my mates telling me stories behind the shelter shed, and you'll do the same. You'll be all right.
Your parents are still coy, aren't they,
I think
about
so,
talking
yeah.
about this stuff?
Yeah, I think so. And it's hard, you know. I, as a parent myself, I've tried to be really honest, but then your own upbringing comes back to haunt you. Think, am I being too honest? Am I saying too much? So yeah, it's confusing for everyone. It's not easy for anyone to work out what to say to their kids, you know. And one of the things that psychologists tell us about talking to kids about sex is answer the question that you're asked. Don't try and extend beyond that. You know, if your 5-year-old is standing in the aisle at the shopping centre and suddenly announces to the world that he has an erection, that's not the time to explain to him what that is. The thing to say there is probably, well, why don't we talk about this when we're back in the car? Mm. And then talk about that and go as far as the questions go rather than say, now, let me explain to you how X and Y chromosomes meet and blend and how DNA works. There's no need for that. I think parents work it out, but I think as long as parents are honest with their kids and go as far as the question takes them, then they're probably all right.
What about a frank talk about the internet, though, especially for boys who are, maybe coming up to high school now, but already aware of this stuff?
I was at a school the other day and I was talking about this book and I was saying to all these Year 8 kids, this is what it's about because you guys are finding... I said, you're finding out about sex off the internet. And this boy at the back had a bit of a chuckle. And I said, yeah, and one day your mum's going to realise that all she has to do is press Control H on the computer and she can see everywhere you've been. And this boy's face just drained of colour. So I think parents need to maybe be a little bit proactive about this as well. I mean, I know in our own home we've made a point of not moving the computer out of the public. It's in the kitchen.
That's very
sensible. I think a lot of people do this, and I think it's a wise thing to do because and maybe we all feel a bit wary of snooping on our kids. It's not like reading the diary there to go to the history and find out exactly where they've been because, a lot of the internet stuff out there isn't just what we call vanilla sex either, which is just a man and a woman having sex. A lot of it is actually really out there. Yeah. And, come on, we don't want 8-year-olds looking at that stuff, seriously.
Yeah, we don't have 12-year-olds or 14-year-olds looking at it, to be honest. James, thanks for joining us. It's been really interesting.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
And good luck with it. James Roy is author of The S Word, A Boy's Guide to Sex, Puberty and Growing Up. It's published by University of Queensland Press. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National and Radio Australia.
Tonight on ABC TV, at 8 o'clock on Australian Story, Greg Combe, the ACTU's Man of Steel. Will he follow others' footsteps?
I see the elements of leadership in him.
And at 8:30 on Four Corners, The Reef, Kakadu, The Snowies, Farmland Devastated. Jonathan Holmes asks, what price will Australians pay to beat climate change? That's tonight on ABC TV.
And right now it's 13 minutes to the hour on ABC Radio National. I'm Richard Adie. You're going to hear a lot about siblings on Life Matters this week. Sibling relationships will be the topic of our Friday talkback. Sibling relationships in adulthood, I should say. To get us thinking, I'd like to introduce writer Kate Veitch. She's one of four siblings and she's written a novel about four siblings called Listen. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Now, having three siblings is unusual now. Tell me about your family.
Fairly typical, I guess, for the 50s when most of us were born. That wasn't at all a big family then. In fact, there were three of us, and then my younger brother, Michael, was quite a lot younger, 8 years younger than me. I was the third and the only girl, which I think makes a big difference.
I've got four sisters. I'm one of five.
Uh-huh.
What was it like growing up with three brothers?
You got to wear a lot of boys' hand-me-downs. Dresses were for special occasions, and they still are.
I'm just thinking, thank God I was the oldest. I haven't thought about that at all. You must get on pretty well with your younger brother, Michael, because you were actually on stage with him the other day.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, we do. We get on very well. It's a real treat that we've both got our first books out right now.
Mm. Now, in your novel, there are four adult siblings, Deborah, James, Robert and the youngest, Meredith.
Mm-hmm.
What's most interesting to you about sibling relationships that forms the stuff of fiction?
I think what I was looking at in this book is how certain things seem to kind of arrive with the package, how certain personalities interact well with each other or poorly with each other right from the word go. Some people seem to be drawn to each other and other people are repelled by each other right from the start. And that can change over time within a family, because within a family you don't get the choice of saying, well, too bad, I just won't see that person, I don't like them.
You can give it a go. I remember once not talking to one of my sisters for a year.
Sure. Yeah, you can give it a go, but you know, on the whole, there's a certain amount of interaction required, and I guess what I'm looking at in this book is how things move and shift and change, not only over time, but with certain crises.
Mm. One of the things I think that comes out of the book is that birth order, you think, is pretty important. Where you are in the family.
In this book, yes, there's an odd kind of symmetry where two pairs of siblings get on with each other, male and female. The first and third get on with each other, and the second and fourth. In some ways, it's the birth order, yes. I have called Robert a classic middle child, and Meredith makes much of the fact that she is the youngest all her life, even when she's into her 40s. She sees herself as the youngest and is out of being a position of both privilege and of it holds her back too. But I have to say, these are characters and this is fiction. It's actually not necessarily, you know, my next novel may well have people that don't relate to that at all.
I want to get on to these characters a bit more in a moment. But before I do, I'm not sure how it is for you and your brothers, but do you find when you all get together as adults, there's an expectation that you have to revert to the relationships and roles that you had in childhood?
To an extent, I think that's true. And I think that certain people do fulfil roles within that family. One person may be the organiser, one person the peacemaker, and one is kind of, you know, might be the family clown. But one doesn't want to be too broad about that because, you know, if you get any of those siblings away with each other separately, then whole different relationships are played out.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the fictional siblings. We've already mentioned Meredith, who seems to be most caught up in her childhood role. What about the eldest child, the high-achieving Deborah? Tell me about her.
Deborah is someone who is, I guess, in terms of what happens within the book, the crisis which occurs to everyone in this family, she in some ways is the one who's most directly affected by it. But something else that I was saying here too is that she was like that anyway. All of these kids were kind of, you know, there was an aspect of their personalities that was set there in any case. She is a highly organised, controlling, bossy sort of person. And I guess if there's one kind of moral lesson that I'm... not that it's a very moral book, but if there is a moral lesson, it's kind of the control freak comes undone. You cannot control other people, or that is what will bring you undone. And I could say that in some ways, of all the characters in the book, I guess I'm most like Deborah myself.
Now, what about James, the good-looking, charming one? He's sort of had this gilded path through life.
Yeah, some people are like that, don't you think?
Yes.
You know, it's like everything they touch turns to gold. Things do come easily to them. And yet what James comes to be faced with is the fact that that very easiness, the way he almost slides through life, when he's faced with making a difficult decision, something that requires a degree of courage in a way, he hasn't got it. He's never practiced difficulty. He's never practiced confrontation. He'll do anything to slide away from that. And so even the one who seems to have the easiest path in life trips up.
Because he hasn't had to go over the hurdles before.
He's been looked after. Yeah, he's been looked after by his elder sister and then by his wife. He appreciates that. It's not that he's ungrateful at all. But when it comes to the point where he has to do something on his own, it's hard for him.
Well, let's talk then about the crisis, the situation that pulls all the siblings together again. It's about their dad, isn't it?
Yes, as they come to realise that their father is in fact entering dementia.
Now, having a parent with dementia is something you've had to grapple with in your family.
Indeed it is, yes. And in the few years before I wrote this book, that is exactly what was happening in my family. After my mother died in 98, we realised rather too late that my mother's whinging and grizzling about Dad's memory wasn't just her whinging and grizzling, that his memory really was going. And it was a slow and painful descent, which I think a lot of people are having to face now as adult children.
Mm. As the only daughter, did you feel more responsible? Did you feel that your brothers wanted you to take the lead?
Yes. Yes, I did. Whether that's because I'm the only daughter, I'm not so sure. Quite a few people suggested that to me, said, oh, well, you're the girl, of course they expect you to do that. And of course you would do that. But
maybe it's
I'm
the control freak part of you.
Exactly, exactly. It was like, I don't know what to do for the best here, but I'd rather I try than anybody else.
I'm not going to trust anyone else to muck this up. I want to muck it up by myself. On Life Matters this morning, we're talking to Kate Veitch, who's the author of a new novel called Listen, and it's all really about sibling relationships. The other big theme in the book is ambivalence about motherhood, and the mother of the siblings we've been talking about does something really quite dramatic in the opening pages of the book.
Are you going to tell them?
Well, I'm wanting you to, actually.
She leaves. She leaves.
And they're quite young.
Yeah, they are quite young. The eldest is just verging on adolescence. It's so interesting, Richard, people's different responses, readers' different responses to the mother's abandonment of her young family. Some people grow to have sympathy for her. Other people are shocked and unforgiving of that character feel it viscerally.
It's such a taboo thing to do, isn't it, for a mother to abandon her children. What interested you about it?
My own mother, although she could never have left. She was far too tied to us all. Nevertheless, she had an ambivalent attitude toward motherhood, I would say. She saw very clearly that in that post-war era, she was one of that multitude of women who had a chance at a career, had a good career as a journalist. And when the men came back from the war, women was expected to go back to the kitchen. She tried in various ways to cobble together a career for herself while we were growing up, but it was difficult. It was difficult for all sorts of practical reasons in terms of childcare, in terms of being stuck in the outer suburbs with very poor public transport. It was difficult too because of the mores of the times, that my father, even though he was a very nice man, nevertheless was not happy about his wife working outside the home. He should be able to support her, and he could. Therefore, she shouldn't be trying to support herself. And it occurred to me to wonder, what would our lives have been like if my mother had been the sort of woman who could have said, well, bugger this, I've had it, I'm out of here.
Mm. And the adult children, like most of us, have various issues. One has an alcohol problem, one has an obsessive compulsive disorder. Are they damaged because their mother left, or would they have been damaged anyway?
Yes. I think that's an interesting question to ponder. I don't have the answers.
Well, you should. You invented them.
I know I invented them, but they do. You know, writers say that thing, and you hear them say, oh, but the characters took over and they lived their own lives and they did these unexpected things, and you think, oh, what rubbish. You invented them. You must know what they're going to be like. But I found it's true. Characters really can take on their own lives. And that's the most fun thing about writing fiction.
Kate, it's been terrific talking to you this morning. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Kate Veitch has been our guest. She's the author of a new novel called Listen, which is published by Penguin. Tomorrow on Life Matters, we'll mark the 12 months since Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans with an interview with the New Orleans lawyer Lisa Matthews. We talked to her last year and heard how she and her mum and her aunt lost their homes in the hurricane. How are they coping now? And what's happened to Lisa's clients, the families going through separation and divorce? Next on ABC Radio National, The Book Show. Today we'll hear about the formidable Mrs. Beaton, she of the famous book of household management. I'm Richard Ady. Thanks for being with me. See you tomorrow.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.